The Book Program, presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest, L.S. Hilton, was named as Glamour Magazine's Writer of the Year in 2016. She grew up in England and has lived in Key West, New York, Paris and Milan. After graduating from Oxford, she studied art history in Paris and Florence. Her novel Maestra was the biggest selling debut of 2016. The shockingly audacious conclusion, Ultima, also featuring glamorous art dealer Elizabeth Tierlink, is out now. Also with us is Roz Watkins, who likes to walk in the Peak District scouting out murder locations. The Devil's Dice is her crime debut, introducing D.I. Meg Dalton. It was shortlisted for the Crime Writers Association Debut Dagger Award and has been optioned for a TV series by ITV Studios. Also with us is Sybil Beadle, who's a mother of two and no stranger to creating impromptu stories for bedtime. The third book in her witchy travel tales series, The Golden Bunny of the Lake District, is perfect for children age 5+. The book features seven very different daughters who have to deal with real problems that young children face today. Also on tonight's show is Karen Hamilton, who spent her childhood in Angola, Zimbabwe, Belgium and Italy and developed a love of travel from moving around so much. This led to her career as a flight attendant, and it was then that she thought of the idea for her debut thriller, The Perfect Girlfriend. And finally on tonight's show is Sarah Davis, who has written Baby Days, a collection of poetry portraying the humorous and sentimental experiences of early motherhood. Covering a myriad of topics that parents of all ages can relate to, the poems are short, accessible and easy to read, even for sleep-deprived new mums. That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is L.S. Hilton, who was named as Glamour Magazine's Writer of the Year in 2016. She grew up in England and has lived in Key West, New York City, Paris and Milan. After graduating from Oxford, she studied art history in Paris and Florence. She's with us back on the book show to talk about her latest novel, Ultima. It's the shockingly audacious conclusion to the international best-selling phenomenon that began with Maestra. Welcome to the book show, Lisa.
Thank you. It's lovely to be with you.
Oh, it's great to have you back on the show. And congratulations. This is the final one in the trilogy. It must be very exciting.
It is. It is. I'm sort of half delighted and half sad to say goodbye to Judith Rashleigh.
Yes, it must be a strange feeling because she's been with you for a while now.
Yeah, she's been living in my head for rather too long, perhaps, a well-dressed sociopath. Perhaps it's time we got rid of her. But certainly working on the latest instalment has been great fun.
So for people who aren't familiar with the character, tell us a bit more about her.
So the story begins with the first volume, Maestra, where Judith is a lowly assistant in a London auction house. She has a huge passion for art, but she realises very quickly that she's not going to be able to achieve her ambitions in a conventional way. Cue quite a lot of murder, art forgery, involvement with the Russian mafia. There are boats, there are guns, there are girls. It's a really thrilling story, one that I hope will be a great page-turner as it progresses across the next two volumes, Domina and Ultima. But it's also a book which is very much about art. The series is very much concerned with looking and perhaps with introducing people to art as well.
Yes, how did you get into the art world?
Well, I studied it, and I thought that I wanted to go and work in an auction house, and I ended up writing books instead. It's a decision that I often regret, but I still review exhibitions, and I still work with art now and again. And it's always been a great passion of mine. It was something that I wanted to communicate to readers, the idea that the art world is actually quite an exciting and wicked place, but also that the art, that great art, is not remote or elitist, that it is vital, that it is dramatic, and that it can be very exciting.
Mm. I always wonder how people value art, you know, who decides that something is worth millions and who decides that something is rubbish.
Well, the answer to that question is found very much in the last pages of Ultima, where Judith's challenge is to fake a painting which has to be worth over £100 million.
Gosh, how do you begin to do that then?
Oh, that was great fun, actually. Researching art forgery was really fascinating. It's an absolutely huge business. It's estimated by the International Art Recovery Service that up to one third of artworks hanging in museums are actually fakes. So there's an awful lot of it about. And because the art world is such a huge and yet an unregulated market, art crime is very widespread and also very advanced. The big auction houses have masses of technology on their side in order to try to detect it, but so do the forgers themselves. So it's really a kind of game of cat and mouse in the sale rooms, detecting what's real and what isn't. And that was the world I wanted to tap into with Ultima.
Gosh, that's so interesting. So there's all this art hanging in museums, and the museums aren't aware that they're fakes.
Or at least the public aren't. But the last book also has a lot of elements and indeed characters which are familiar from the first two. It's got quite exciting locations. This time the story takes us to Tangier in Morocco and Baku in Azerbaijan, amongst other places. It's got a lot of fashion, it's got a little bit of sex, and a lot of drama.
Yeah, is it fair to say addicted to sex, this character?
I wouldn't say addicted. I'd say she's modern. I think she takes a modern view of sex. She's certainly unapologetic about her sexuality. She takes quite an unemotional view of it. She enjoys sex and she's not afraid to show it. But I was quite surprised when the books were received as being sort of erotic thrillers, because I didn't think they were particularly. I just tried to write about sex in what felt to me like a modern 21st century way. I mean, we live in a world of Tinder and sexting, and it seems that the literary world hasn't quite caught up with that.
It's interesting that there aren't more female characters who have that sort of attitude to sex.
Well, I think so, because when you look at what real women are doing in real life online all the time, I don't see many of them feeling, you know, ashamed or apologetic about sex. But if you actually, you know, write about a woman who enjoys her body, you know, the newspapers get terribly ruffled and it's seen as scandalous, which I think is rather silly. There's a sort of disconnect between what's allowed on the page and what happens in real life. I mean, I've said before that you can do almost anything to a woman's body in terms of violence in thrillers. You can do unspeakably disgusting things to women, but you can't allow them to enjoy their own bodies. I find that an absurd paradox.
Yeah, definitely. You've been compared to E.L. James, haven't you?
Oh,
headlines
God.
Saying, is this geeky Oxford graduate
no,
the new E.L.
no.
James?
The answer is no. If you liked 50 Shades, do not read this book. It is not a love story. It will make you unhappy. In fact, my favourite of my bad reviews from 50 Shades fans, there was the one which said, this book is an insult to E.L. James. it's the very opposite of what E.L. James was doing in her stories. And the fact that there's some supposed erotic connection, again, I think you'd have to read the two to compare, but I don't really see it myself.
Mm. So what's next for you then? After this is the last one in the trilogy, as we said, are you going to start something completely different?
I probably might go back and write another history book, because that's my original background. I think I'd probably like to do something a bit scholarly, and then I have a whole list of thrillers that I'd like to write. I'm quite interested in spies and in the supernatural. So, yeah, it's just really a matter of deciding which one to do first.
Oh, all very different.
Yeah, I think that's important. I think I would hate to be the sort of writer who just wheeled out the same character year after year. I think that's boring for readers, and I think it's boring for writers as well. I think you want to evolve, and you want to keep telling different stories.
It's great that you have the skill to be able to do that. Some authors couldn't do different genres.
Oh, I don't know about skill. I think it's more because I'm not really very good at anything else. You know, if I could get a proper job, I would. But as you know from the beginning of our interview, I can barely even work my iPhone. I'm kind of unemployable, so I'm a bit stuck with the stories, I think.
Do you not think of this as a proper job then? How long do you spend writing?
Well, I treat it like a proper job. I mean, I have a certain time when I get to my desk every day, and I sit there, you know, until a certain amount of time has passed. I suppose it's more that I don't know, making things up seems like such an absurd luxury. I find it difficult to be pompous about it. I just feel really, really lucky, and that's what's so wonderful about hearing from readers of the Maestro series all over the world, to feel that I've made a story which has engaged people, made them excited, made them angry, indeed. That feels like a great privilege.
It must be great getting feedback from readers.
Oh, some of it is. Yeah, I have a readers' club, which is wonderful. They tend to be quite enthusiastic, and then there's quite a lot of cross people on Amazon. But we had a lot of fun with that for the publicity campaign for Ultima. We made a video which you can see on Instagram, where I just read out some of the worst reviews. So we try to turn that into a positive. And actually, I think that if you write a story that engages people, even if it engages them negatively, in a sense you've done your job. I mean, you wouldn't want to write a book that people just thought was nice, would you?
No, absolutely. That's very brave of you, though, making that video.
Oh no, not at all. It was good fun. And I think also it's important not to take oneself too seriously. I think I'm really grateful to be able to do what I do, and I couldn't possibly get offended by a bad review, because it means that someone's given their time to my work. So I'm very grateful even for bad reviews.
Yeah, that's very nice. Well, if people want to get a copy of Ultima, it is out now. It's the final instalment in the series that began with Maestra. Presumably, if people haven't read the first two books, it makes sense that they start at the beginning, does it?
No, I mean, that's ideal, but each of the novels is designed to be read alone as well. So if you fancy the title, you can certainly start with Ultima and read backwards. In fact, that might be quite fun.
Why not? Well, Lisa, it's great to have you with us again. Thank you very much for joining us.
It's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray. This is TRE. The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Ros Watkins, who likes to walk in the Peak District scouting out murder locations. She's with us on the Book Show to talk about her white knuckle crime debut, introducing D.I. Meg Dalton. It was shortlisted for the Crime Writers Association Debut Dagger Award and has been optioned for a TV series by ITV Studios. Welcome to the Book Show, Ros.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And how does it feel having your first book out?
Oh, it's been amazing, actually. I feel a bit, it's just been such a strange few weeks. It came out a few weeks ago now, and it's like when a dream actually comes true. It's so odd, you know. I remember seeing it in the bookshop, my sort of local bookshop, seeing it in the window there, and just the whole thing about actually picking up your own book, it's been incredible.
Oh, how wonderful. And have you wanted to write for a long time then? What's your background?
I always sort of wanted to, in a fairly vague way. As a child I wanted to, but then I ended up sort of doing a proper job and kind of got sidetracked from it, really. I never thought it was a very serious ambition. So I did a job as a patent attorney, so the same job as the corpse in my novel, for about 15 years. And while I did that, that was a sort of really full-on job. So I didn't do any writing at all in that time. And it was only when I left that and bought some holiday cottages, and I was sort of renovating those and knocking mortar out of walls and doing much more practical things. And I found my brain started sort of coming up with all these, I think it might be when I was working with builders, actually, like ways to kill people. And that sort of set me writing some short stories, and it kind of went on from that, really. So it wasn't very well planned. It sort of just happened in a way.
Yes. And how did you find it then when you got round to writing the book?
Once I started writing the book, I'd realised I had no idea how to write a book. Because, you know, we've all read lots of books, so we kind of think, yeah, I'll sit down, I'll write one. And then once I started, I thought, no, actually, I don't know what I'm doing. But I decided that this had to be something you could learn. So I just set about learning how to write. I thought, if I'm going to write a book, I might as well try and write one that stood a chance of being published. So I kind of found all the books I could on how to write a publishable novel. I looked at stuff on the internet from agents and editors and all the advice, you know, what makes them reject. A lot of them say they decide within one page that they're not interested. So what is it that they're seeing? And I analysed recently published books and tried to work out what they were doing. So as well as having something I really wanted to write about that I felt quite strongly about, I also approached it quite sort of strategically, I suppose, in a way.
Mm. And as you went on with the writing of the book, did you kind of get the hang of it and think, oh yes, I think I can do more of these?
I didn't really think about writing more than one, actually. So I sort of was just working like crazy on the first one, and I felt like I threw my entire life into it, really. You know, everything that I felt strongly about, every kind of funny anecdote, you know, all sort of went in there. And then it's quite funny when you get an agent and she said to me, oh, just tell me about books 2 and 3. And I thought, well, I haven't really got books 2 and 3, but I will create books 2 and 3 if you think you can find someone who's interested in them. So I was beginning to have some ideas about book 2, and then book 3 I just kind of made something up and went on from there.
So tell us about your main character, D.I. Meg Dalton.
So she's a detective, and she's been promoted quite quickly, but what I didn't want her to be was this sort of either the sort of usual drunken kind of detective, or the cliche of the sort of female detective who's very glamorous and who runs around in 3-inch heels apprehending criminals. So I wanted to try and make her fairly normal sort of person, like, you know, my friends, and kind of someone doing a challenging job and struggling with it, but hopefully struggling in a reasonably believable way, although I did end up giving her a bit more baggage than I'd intended to, because you end up, my agent always says drama trumps realism, so you do end up perhaps making things a bit more dramatic.
Yes.
Just keep the story going. So she's got a fairly difficult past, and it all kind of comes to light in the first book. She's trying to make a name for herself in Derbyshire. There's obviously her colleagues, some of them are helpful, some of them less so. But I think she kind of tries to see the funny sides, although it's quite dark. I've met detectives, and although they're dealing with some really awful things, they sort of use humour to deal with it. So I tried to have that in the book as well, so it doesn't get too depressing, hopefully.
Yeah, I think we like to read about or watch people who seem to be relatively normal, you know, as well as battling with their daily job and the things that come with it, that they also have issues in their family life or with their kids or their parents. And I know that your book's been compared to the likes of Broadchurch and Happy Valley, and they're prime examples of having strong female characters who also have a lot going on in their personal life as well as a tough police job.
Yeah, I really love both of those, so it was just incredible to be compared to them, because I love the way they were done, and the humour, and like you say, the sort of normal people. And in my detective, she's a bit fat, and she sort of worries about, you know, that she never seems to eat properly, and that she's always trying to be more healthy and do Pilates and stuff, but she never quite gets around to it. And it's just like me and my friends, really, you know, we sort of... You might be doing quite a difficult job, but you've got all this other stuff going on as well. And she's got her mother is kind of a little bit troublesome in various ways. She's sort of trying to deal with her. So, yeah, hopefully she's sort of like a real character that people can believe in.
Mm. And they're set in the Peak District, which I know is where you live, isn't it?
Yeah, so we're just sort of on the edge of the Peak District. We've got holiday cottages, and it is really beautiful, and it's got lots of places, sort of caves and cliffs and quarries and lots of potential places to bury bodies and find dodgy things going on. So I always walk the dog around here. So while I was walking the dog, I'd have these ideas about, you know, interesting if we found a corpse. I'm not sure it's normal, but so in the first book, I have actually got a corpse in a cave discovered by a Labrador.
Oh, is your dog a Labrador?
He's a rescue, so we don't know for sure, but we think he's probably Husky Cross. They said Husky Cross Labrador, and he's greedy enough to be a Labrador, but yeah, we're not sure exactly.
Oh, how lovely. So tell me, in this book then, The Devil's Dice, Peter Hugo Hamilton is the attorney who's found dead at the beginning of the book. What do we know about him?
So he's found dead in a cave by this Labrador, and when Meg Dalton, the detective, turns up, and her and the crime scene people, they peel back some foliage from the back wall of the cave, and they find that there's a carving on there that's been there over 100 years, and it was all covered up by the leaves and stuff, but it's a carving of the Grim Reaper, and it's got the dead man's initials sort of hewn into the wall under it. So it almost seems as if this carving was predicting his death, which obviously doesn't make any sense. But then all the locals start talking about a curse, and apparently this man, he lives in a house, and people who live in that house keep dying. So the locals are saying it's cursed, and obviously the detective, she doesn't believe any of that. And she's looking into his sort of life and who might have a motive, which obviously is lots of people, because he's a patent attorney like I was, and he's been making mistakes and doing things which potentially make his partners liable for a huge amount of money. So it's potentially a lot more convenient for them if he's dead than if he's there and not making mistakes.
Right.
There are lots of motives and lots of suggestions of sort of weird supernatural things going on, but Meg's convinced there's a much more rational explanation, which she's got to find.
Interesting. So how does she get on? Because she has to prove herself, doesn't she, in a police force dominated by men?
Yeah, I mean, her boss is actually not too bad, but there's a colleague there who wanted her job and is very annoyed that they brought somebody in from... She was in the Manchester force, and she's been brought into Derbyshire. So he thought he was going to get the inspector job, and then they brought her in. And she's also fast track, so she's one of these sort of university types who's been promoted quite quickly. And he's not very impressed with that. So she has a few problems with him, but I've kind of tried to give him some reasons for being the way he is. So he's not just a sort of unpleasant character, but in the first book, he is quite unpleasant, so she struggles with how to deal with him because she sort of doesn't want to get on the wrong side of him too badly, but if she's too nice to him, he just abuses that. So she's sort of walking that knife edge, really, between, you know, she's sort of kind of part of, I mean, I've worked in a lot of male-dominated environments, and sometimes I think it's quite difficult as to whether you try and be one of the lads or you set yourself apart from them a bit, and it's quite challenging for her.
So. Definitely. Yeah. It's interesting. I guess there's politics in most places of work, and I think a lot of people reading the book will relate to that side of it as well.
Hopefully, yeah.
Well, if people want to get a copy of The Devil's Dice, it is out now. It's by Ros Watkins, who we've been chatting to today. Ros, do you know when the second book's due to come out?
It's March next year, so about a year after the first one.
Okay, fantastic. Well, for the time being, listeners can get a copy of The Devil's Dice. Ros, thank you very much for joining us, and best of luck.
Well, thank you. Thanks ever so much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Sybil Beadle to talk about her latest book. You can join Miranda the Witch and her seven daughters on their next exciting adventure to the Lake District. It's in the third title in the magical children's book series, Witchetty Travel Tales. The third book in the series is out now. It's The Golden Bunny of the Lake District. Welcome to the book show, Sybil.
Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And what a lovely idea for a story and the whole series. I think it's great. Where did it all come from?
Oh, this is a very interesting question. Actually, the reason I started writing children's books is a bit of a sad one. When my ex-husband left and we were getting divorced, my kids struggled to fall asleep when they were at his. And when they went on holiday for the first time for 2 weeks, my kids begged me for a good night story every night. So I started texting them parts of this story that I was just making up as I was going. And because I have found it very difficult to be separated from them for 2 weeks, I got hiking to the Lake District. And I was hiking with my dog in the Lake District, and every night I was texting them the continuation of the story, and those text messages became the first draft of my story.
Oh, fantastic. They loved the story, didn't they, and the characters?
They absolutely loved the story, and every night when I send them a couple of paragraphs of the story, they would send me loads of emojis and saying, "Mommy, tell us more, tell us more." So I got really motivated. I mean, I have made up stories for them at bedtime all my life. But because I had to text it to them, I started writing it down.
Mm.
So that's how, rather than just storytelling, it became story writing. And then when they came back from vacation, they asked me if they could read the story to their classmates. And that's when I thought, oh my God, I need to edit the story to make it better.
Yes, brilliant. So tell us a bit more about Miranda the Witch.
Okay, so Miranda is an immigrant witch. She arrives at the south of England by boat with her seven daughters on a stormy night, and she's searching for a better home for her children. And they set home on the Seven Sister Cliffs south of England, and then from there they go on a lot of adventures. So there are a lot of ancient sites, magical sites in England, and they visit these ancient sites to activate ancient spells. So, for example, the second book, they go to Stonehenge, because in the second book, Stonehenge is created by some witches as a protection for a kid that's sleeping in the middle of it in a little tent. And the Stonehenge is created to keep the animals and all the scary creatures at bay so that the child can sleep without the fear. And so basically there is a spell buried in Stonehenge, and they go to discover this spell so that one of the daughters of Miranda, who struggles to sleep at night, is able to sleep.
What a great idea. And have you seen it have an impact on children and helping them to sleep more?
Yes, it definitely does. And what's absolutely fascinating about my books is when children listen to my stories, they want to go to these places. So my first book is about the Seven Sister Cliffs. The second book is about Stonehenge. The third book is the Lake District. And the fourth one, which I finished just a week ago, is taking place in Scotland. And it's called Nessie's Husband. And that's a book where Mimi, a half-cat, half-human daughter of hers, is bullied in school, and she wants to learn to become invisible. So she wants to go in search of Nessie to Scotland, and the story is how they end up finding her husband.
Oh, wonderful. And the idea is of creating these seven daughters, seven characters, is they're all very different, aren't they? Not only showing different personalities and appearances, but also they battle with different issues that children face today, like bullying that you mentioned.
They all battle with certain issues. Mimi is half cat, half human, and she wishes she was just cat or just human. So she's struggling with those issues, and she struggles at school. Then, you know, some of the children, one of them has dyslexia, one of the children can read minds, and because of that she's very scared of people because she doesn't want to hear what they think. And one of the children falls in love very easily and very easily believes people, is very naive. So all the children have traits that are very human. And when I read these books in schools, there is always, every single child can find a character that they associate with.
And that's very important, I think, isn't it, for kids growing up, to be able to be interested in reading and storytelling, to be able to relate to some of the characters.
Yes, and also they sort of love it that the characters are magical, but they have flaws. And kids feel very comfortable to see that another child has similar problems, like falling asleep at night, even though she's a witch's daughter. And it's very touching how the witch sort of takes them to Stonehenge trying to get rid of this problem of her daughters, or how she takes them to Scotland trying to help her daughter with her wish to become invisible. And what happens is on the trip, instead of learning to become invisible, she learns how to deal with her problems.
Mm, I see, yes. And Miranda the witch, obviously she's a good witch.
She's a very good witch. She's a terrible driver. She reads a lot. She spends all her time reading books and spells and potions. She's a very good mom, very sensitive, not a perfect mom, so she's not always able to do everything, but if her children have a problem, she deals with them. She sort of is very interested, listens to it, and tries to help them, even if she doesn't know the solution. So it's, I think kids feel very close to her as a character, and a lot of kids say to me, oh, I wish Miranda was my mother.
That's nice. It must be great for you to get direct feedback from the children, is it?
Yes, I do hundreds of book readings in schools. I go to a lot of schools in the area, and sometimes I read to 400 or 500 children in one go. And when I first had to do that, it was a little bit scary, because I thought, oh my God, how am I going to keep their attention? But once I start reading the story and I take my assistant with me, who shows off big printouts of the illustrations, the kids are absolutely fascinated. And then after the reading, they can't stop asking questions. And it's so satisfying.
Yes.
And I also went to my kids' school. And in my kids' school, the kids sort of look at me as a hero. They absolutely loved it. It was so nice.
Oh, that's so lovely. Your kids must be so proud, are they?
They are very proud. So the 10-year-old tries not to show it because she's a little bit of a teenager already. But behind my back, she brags to all of them that her mom is a children's book author.
Oh, how lovely.
And my 8-year-old openly just sort of says that she has the best mommy in the world and tells everybody she's writing a story and, yeah, doesn't stop talking about it.
Oh, that's really sweet. And the books are aimed at children sort of 5+, would you say?
5+. I mean, I am reading it now in primary schools up to year 6, and it's very well received by the children. I mean, for years 2 and 3, they can start reading the book on their own. It's a little bit maybe difficult for them, but it is a story that can be read to them or they can read on their own. And what I also noticed is that the kids, when they have the series, they want to keep going back and reading book 1, book 2 again, and then they compare things. And in the illustrations are fascinating. Fernando, my illustrator, and I, we always hid a little bit of information in the illustrations. So when they are reading the book, they can also sort of look out for what else is hidden in the pictures.
Clever stuff. Well, if people want more information on the books and the characters, they can have a look on the website, witchytraveltales.com.
Witchytraveltales, yeah.
And the third book in the series is out now, The Golden Bunny of the Lake District. How many books do you think they're going to be?
I currently have the ideas for 7 of them, and I finished writing 5 of them.
Okay.
So I'm currently going through a very productive phase. I don't know how long this will last.
Make the most of it.
I'll make the most of it while the ideas are flowing in my head. But to be honest, because I have two young kids, I go on road trips with them. I'm going this weekend to Norfolk with them. And I'm taking two of their friends with me. So I'm with four kids, and I'm just going to write the whole weekend. I collect so many ideas to write when I'm in a place with them. Because I basically, you know, I take inspiration from the children, and then they can find a lot of things that have happened on these trips in the books again.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure when I go to Norfolk, I'm going to Bewilder Woods, and I'm sure I'll come up with some ideas, and then I can jot them down while I'm there.
Yes, great. Well, enjoy your trip, and we look forward to seeing more in the Witchy Travel Tales books as the years go on.
Thank you so much. Have a lovely day.
You too, Sybil Beadle. Thank you very much for joining us.
Bye-bye.
TRE.radio. The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Karen Hamilton, who spent her childhood in Angola, Zimbabwe, Belgium and Italy, and developed a love of travel through moving around so much. This led her to a career as a flight attendant, and it was in the air that she thought of the idea for her debut thriller, The Perfect Girlfriend, which aims to explore not only obsession, but also the true faces behind those who go to work in uniform. Welcome to the book show, Karen.
Thanks very much.
Oh, thanks so much for joining us, and congratulations. How does it feel
to
have your debut novel out?
It's just so exciting. Thank you.
Oh.
Yeah, it's a dream come true, to be honest. So, yeah, I still have to keep pinching myself to believe it's true.
So when did the idea come to you in the air?
The idea came to me when I was changing out of uniform one day before I was travelling on public transport. I found people, when you wear a uniform, I found that people ask for directions a lot when you're out in public, and I have a really, really rubbish sense of direction. So I remember, as I changed, feeling the sense of returning to anonymity, and I think that was the point that it sparked the idea of somebody who is a different face to the one they show the real world. And it got me thinking about, what if this character wasn't very nice? What would she be like? And I started to develop her from there.
Oh, great. So this is Juliet.
Yes, this is Juliet. Juliet is very much in love with an airline pilot named Nate, and she wants to marry him. She wants the perfect life, the perfect ending, the perfect ever after. But there's just one slight snag, which is that Nate dumped her 6 months ago. So she decides not to let this deter her, and she comes up with a plan. And it starts off with checking him out on social media, and she still has a key to his apartment where they used to live, so she lets herself in when he's away on trips just to keep him a closer eye. And when that's not enough, she gets a job as a flight attendant for the same airline as him, because she wants this plan to win him back, to win, you know, to work at all costs. And what I did with her was I decided to try and create a character that works outside normal social boundaries, just to see how far she'd go, really. So, yeah, she's not very nice.
So, as a reader, then, we're not supposed to like her?
No, she's a very damaged woman, and she's very, very determined. And that determination means that she will let nothing or no one get in her way, and she will use any means possible to achieve her goal, which is to win back this man of her dreams.
And do we get to meet Nate much in the book?
Yes. Nate is there. He deals with Juliet as if she is a normal person, unaware of her true nature. He dumps her because he feels that she's become a bit too cloying, but he has no idea of the extent of the damage and the extent of her determination and how much she's working behind the scenes to get him back.
How long did it take you to come up with the characters then and kind of plan the kind of person that Nate would be compared to Juliet?
I thought that they were in my head. I know a lot of writers say this, actually, but they were in my head for a long time, and I had an idea of what they would be like. Nate is very privileged. He has had quite an easy path in life, which is the total opposite to Juliet's. And one of the ways I developed Juliet's character was amongst other things, I did a lot of research into sociopaths and nature versus nurture, but I also read a lot of self-help books, and I tried to imagine that what if someone was reading them not to try and improve themselves or to heal or to make a better life for themselves, but they were using some of the very powerful language and ideas to justify their actions. Mm. And I felt that kind of made her a bit scarier, the fact that she's constantly, it's a first-person narrative, so you're constantly in her head, so you're constantly aware of how she's justifying some not normal behaviour and making it sound reasonable.
Yeah. Was it difficult for you to kind of get out of her head and get back to your normal life when you weren't writing?
It was, actually. It was. I don't know if I should confess that too much, but yeah, no, it was. I did quite often find myself in sort of like seemingly normal situations, like if I was on a bus or somewhere, and think like, what would she do if she was here? How would she think? Mm. And yes, it was hard when I stopped writing her to change, you know, not think like that anymore. Now that I'm writing a different book, thinking in a different character's head. But she was good fun to write. Well, worryingly good fun, actually.
Yeah.
And it, like I say, I pushed outside of normal social boundaries just to see how far she would get away with it. And also with the larger airlines, you're working with different crew every week. You're always meeting new people. So I thought it'd be a great environment in which to hide her, because as long as she could behave for a few hours, no one would suspect the true, you know, her true nature.
Mm. And how long were you a flight attendant for?
I was a flight attendant for many years, about 16.
Wow.
And I loved it. But I don't think that will come across in the book, given the genre and Juliet's nature.
No.
But I absolutely love flying. And I mean, with the training as well that you have with flying, you learn how to handcuff people in survival situations. And again, I just thought a character like Juliet would use all these skills, but in not the right way.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And I understand you were a recent graduate of the Faber Academy. What was that like?
Yes, that's right. That was amazing. That worked, you know, very well for me. I'd been writing for about 9 years. Well, actually, I would have been writing for 9 years when the book came out. But prior to that, I had been writing for a number of years. I'd written two other books before that. I hadn't got anywhere with them. I'd done some online courses. I went to literary festivals. I went to meet the author events, listened to interviews. And I tried to learn as much as possible. And the Faber Academy course just helped me put all that knowledge together to hopefully hone my craft. And I think you're always learning. But it was the feedback. It's learning to accept feedback and what you do with that feedback. And at the end of the course, you read your work out aloud, well, as a short extract to a room full of agents and editors, which is very nerve-wracking. But luckily for me, it paid off. So it really, really was worth it for me, and a dream come true.
Oh, great stuff. And how long is the course?
The course that I did was 6 months, and it was one evening a week and one Saturday a month. I have three young children, so my in-laws and my mum and family were very kind and helpful with childcare, which enabled me to do it. And it was great to have that time to really dedicate yourself to writing, and when it's taken seriously, where you start to think, oh yeah, maybe it is possible. And I think as well, you meet a lot of other people who are in the same situation, and that's a massive support. And we still meet, actually, everyone I met on the course, we still meet once a month, and we still critique each other's work, sometimes over a glass of wine as well. But that support has been amazing.
Mm.
And it's really, because you work on your own so much, as I'm sure, again, probably a lot of writers say, it's great to have that connection with people.
Yeah, absolutely. And it must be difficult juggling your time, though, with kids as well. How do you find the time to write? Or how do you make the time to write?
Yes, I used to. I'm a morning person, so I will get up early and try and fit in as much as I can. My youngest started school recently, so I use the day, school day, as my working day.
Mm.
From 9 till 3. I set that aside. And, if I'm on a deadline or if I need to do more, then definitely I'll get up in the morning. Or at the weekends, I'll try and carve out some time when my husband's not working. And wherever I can, really. I mean, if I think, if I think I'm going to get a chance to write, I will take my laptop out with me. I've done it. It's like children's soft play areas. Do a lot on trains, I think. I think perhaps, again, a lot of writers do that.
Yeah.
A lot on trains. And I edit on my Kindle as well, so that's always with me. So I'll try and edit then.
Mm.
So I just, because I love it, I just try and fit it in wherever I can.
Yeah, absolutely. Doesn't feel like a job, I guess, does it? It's something you've always wanted to do.
No, that's where I feel so lucky, really, because it never feels like a job. So yeah, to get paid to do something you've always wanted to do, it doesn't seem real.
So is there a book two on the horizon?
Yes, I'm currently working on a book two. It's another damaged female protagonist, set in a very different world this time. It's not the airline world, it's a very different world. It's in the book world. And I'm enjoying this as much as I did the first. So it's great to get my teeth into another complex character.
Mm. And it's in the book world, you say?
Yes, it's set in the book world. I enjoyed writing about the airline world, and now I thought this would be another interesting area to work in. So, yes, I'm enjoying it very much.
Well, good luck with the second book, and good luck with the first book as well. The Perfect Girlfriend is out now, and it's by Karen Hamilton, who we've been chatting to. Karen, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Talk Radio Europe.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Sarah Davis, who's put together a poetry collection portraying the humorous and sentimental experiences of early motherhood, covering a myriad of topics that parents of all ages can relate to. And based upon the author's personal experiences, the poems are short, accessible and easy to read, even for sleep-deprived new mums. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us, and congratulations. What's it like to have a book out?
Oh, it's really exciting. And my six-year-old son, who the poems were based around in his early days, is very thrilled to have a book about him too.
Oh, how lovely. Because you weren't intending to write a book at all, were you?
No, I think I was just inspired by being a new mum and all the feelings and emotions that came with it. And the poems started as spontaneous thoughts and outpourings while up for the 3 a.m. feeds. And I guess it was maybe just a combination of our long wait for a baby and the intensity of the feelings, the hormones, and maybe the peace and quiet. But maybe I'm just more creative at that time of the morning.
So have you been writing poetry since, or was it just at that time of your life?
I have written some since, yes. Sort of same subject, really, but more into sort of toddlers and older children now. My degree was English, and I'm a primary school teacher, so I've tended to write little bits and pieces for my classes and things like that when I've been teaching. So this is my first venture into a book. I've never tried to get anything published before, so this is all new.
Great. So what kind of, how long are the poems then? Do they all rhyme? Tell me about the structure.
They're different, really. Some of them rhyme, some of them don't. Some are longer than others, but they're all fairly short, so they're all very easily accessible for new mums to read, really. And I think the thing was, when I decided that I would go ahead and get them published, at the time when I was looking into it, then there was nothing else around for new mums other than sort of really advice books and magazines and things like that when I had my son. So these are quite short and accessible, really.
Can you share a couple with us?
Yeah, one of my favourites is Mums and Baby Groups, because, again, I just felt like sometimes you feel a bit isolated as a new mum, and it's nice to know that other people are going through the same kind of things as yourself. So here we go. Mums and Babies Group. My local Mums and Babies Group helps to keep me sane, with adult conversation to stimulate my brain. When I am feeling anxious, it helps to get me through, to hear that all the other mums have fears and worries too. We talk about our babies and get stuff off our chest and reassure each other we can only do our best. We have a laugh and giggle about the week we've had, sharing our experience, the good things and the bad. By the time our tea is finished and we've put the world to rights, we're re-energised to face another week of sleepless nights.
Oh, that's fabulous. That's really good. I bet so many mums can relate to that.
And I think the poems go through all sorts of topics that parents can relate to, things like feeding, changing, that kind of thing, expectations, hopes, aspirations for the future. And the one that I started with was the first scan, and that's called Getting to Know You. The scan and seeing the beating of your tiny little heart, knowing that it's really only just the very start. Growing ever bigger as you struggle to find room, feeling kicks and hiccups as you move inside the womb, hearing your first cries just as you come into the world, beginning your life's journey soon to be unfurled. The gripping of my finger with your tiny little hand, the feelings and emotions only parents understand.
Oh, that's really beautiful. Really lovely. I'm all smiles, Sarah.
Oh, thank you.
That's so nice.
And there are other poems that are sort of funnier poems, you know, more humorous, more to do with, like, the craziness of parenthood, really. You know, things like the washing machine, things like what happens when you're going out and things all conspiring against you at the time, that kind of thing. Feeling like you're a human milk machine and you've got no time to cook or clean and time to get things done. All those sorts of things, really, all the topics that new mums and can relate to.
Yeah. Can you give us another one, a fun one?
Okay. Family meals out. Taking baby out when weaning can be an ordeal, especially if he's having pureed carrot for his meal. Try dressing him in orange. It's a very useful tip. Instead of lots of changing, it helps conceal each trip. You've no time for fashion or designer wear. You have barely had the time to shower and wash your hair. Forget what suits your colouring, as by the end of the night, your jumper will be orange, though it started out as white.
Oh, great stuff. I love it. Well, if people want to read more of these poems, they must get a copy of your book. It's called Baby Days, as in D-A-Z-E, and it's by Sarah Davis, who we've been chatting to today. Sarah, do you think there'll be more poetry books on the horizon?
I'm considering writing a sequel, more to do with, as I say, the toddler years and sort of early school time. So that's something that I'm working on at the moment, so hopefully.
Oh, well, best of luck with that. Sarah, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.